Imagine learning indigenous language from an AI, from a friendly avatar, or an immersive dreamscape. Imagine flying through landscapes created of Iroquois symbols, or examining digital regalia in virtual space. And imagine gathering with friends and family in these created environments to practice speaking in your native language.
Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like linguistics, technology, game and object design, and ethics. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by Monigar, the founder of Monigar.com, a small tech company based in the Akwesasne Indian Reservation. Monigar develops XR, aka extended reality, solutions and custom software with a focus on indigenous language revival, futurism, and culture.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's wonderful to have you here and talk about your work. Can we start by sort of unpacking what is XR? What are extended reality environments?
Sure. So in my world, XR, it's a term we use for a lot of different things. So augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality, 360 film, 180 film, even spatial audio. So it's extended reality on top of the real world.
So when you mean on top of the real world, again, just if you could sort of draw a picture for a listener that might not have any idea, I mean, is it sort of like Pokemon Go kind of thing where you might have artificial digital objects and characters overlaid on real-time video of the real world?
So in my world, I see as extending the physical world with whatever I have to work with. So it might be like last year, I had these Bose augmented reality sunglasses. And in that, there's only audio. So when you're walking to certain GPS points, you can hear my language being spoken. And I'm actually directing you, look at this rock where there was like a beautiful picture on it. And it tells you a little story about it. So I'm just laying over the real physical world, just extended things. That might be audio, it might be visuals, even things that don't exist yet, like maybe smells right now. It's extending the real physical world.
So this is your job. This is what you do. You got this job how? How does someone become an XR artisan? I don't know if that's the word or...
My husband last night was describing my work. He said I'm a dream stylist because I'm like bringing people into like some of my dreams and my imagination. Like I can actually put you into like how I see the world with virtual reality, which is very much like going into some of my dreams. How I got into it, I definitely have had a life experience that's not mainstream. So I left home when I was really young. In the 70s, I was raised in an Indian reservation with my grandparents. Awesome people. They just treated me so well, like a human being. But then I was forcefully removed to go live with a family that's not Native. So I lived from the time I was maybe 5 or 6 years old with this family, and I was kept isolated. It was very abusive and violent. So I was about 13 or 14 years old. So I decided as a young child to just leave. My first attempt, I lived in the forest overnight, you know, because I was just a kid. I'm trying to figure out how do I escape this violence, you know, without hurting anyone or myself. So I stayed in the forest because I've always loved the forest. That didn't work out too well. My second attempt, I did make it to a city. And that's a whole other story. So how I got into this job that I'm in now is that I had this life experience where I'm not led by fear. Of course, I feel fear, you know, and I'm scared of things. Especially violent genocidal colonization is the best way to describe it. But I don't allow that to lead my work. I don't allow it to lead my relationships with people. And so I do things that are really considered not too normal or even neurodivergent. So I made my job, really.
This could be like a whole program all in its own. But given that background, at some point you must have been in front of a video game or something where all the light bulbs went off. And I'm just curious what that looked like.
So in the mid-70s, I was always around war veterans, male war veterans. So the male war veterans have a huge impact and influence on my life and how I see the world. They were communication specialists and even in the front lines of war. So the non-Native family I went to go live with, they had a Tandy TRS-80 in the house and told me, don't touch it. Yeah, right? From Radio Shack. And like no one else had those. So I didn't have anyone to talk with and I'm like isolated. So when no one's around, which was often, I would sneak in there because I was just learning how to read and I would follow the instructions in the book and I started programming Eliza right out of the book. The neat thing for me was, and it's really a huge impact on my work, is having these people that really had a lot of hate for me, not knowing that I'm building that, I would sneak around. I'd even be hiding up by the ceiling and watching these people that hated my guts having fun playing the software program I just made. Like they were laughing and smiling and giggling, like a grown man giggling that I usually only seen angry, you know. Even today, I get really excited when I can build these solutions on machines that are respectful and communicate and show how I see the world in ways that people can benefit and be happy and respected. Like, that's just amazing to me.
I just think it's amazing that you built an AI as a kid in the 70s on a Tandy, but you built your AI chatbot in the 90s, right? What was the motivation for building that?
Remember, I left home when I was 13 or 14 and life was really hard. I was a homeless teenager. So I would go into libraries, public libraries, because it was a little safer there. And sometimes they'd even have computers that I could mess with. And I went literally overnight from being a homeless street urchin to having a job in tech. Like a huge life change, like being below poverty for all my life to getting this six-figure job overnight because I did the interview and Carrier Corporation was my first big one. They hired me. Man, that was exciting. And back then, they didn't have these language translators and speech engines and things like that that we have today. So that's what I helped Carrier Corporation to do. Asian speakers could communicate and collaborate on the same project with English speakers.
So that's like what a chatbot is? Is that where you can type in phrases and it translates for you?
Yeah.
The crossover that you do of language and software and imagination is just a really interesting place. It's not something that gets taught at school, you know? So I'm curious about the journey that brought you to where you are.
Yeah. So Carrier, that is part of the journey. And it does go back to my grandparents when I was young. They were so below poverty, like we didn't even have running water, like we had an outhouse. Then to go live with this non-Native family who had excessive money and resources. So I've been in these really stark contrasting worlds, but at my grandparents, I still remember the conversation with my grandmother teaching me about respect, about even these machines. Like there are beings in all of these machines. And when we don't respect them or we're using them to do disrespectful things, that's what we output to the world. So I went from homeless to working in the corporate world. I was definitely a workaholic. So I was working nonstop to the point of burnout. I was doing it to myself, but I was extremely lonely and I was becoming disconnected to my grandparents, disconnected to everything that makes me a human being. Because I was just like, wow, let's make all this money and I'm in the tech world and oh my God, I can buy my own car, you know, all these things that I didn't have before. And so the jump over to building bots, the best way I can describe it is I was feeling like desperately lonely and scared because to be in the world as a young woman in an industry that's known for being very toxic towards women and very dangerous. So one day I said, you know what? I think what it is, I miss speaking in my language that I grew up with as a child. Like I'm losing my identity and becoming this overworked robot. So I just started building these bots that speak my own language for myself. It was selfish. That's what started it.
I build physical robots. And
nice.
So back in the day, I was given a t-shirt that said, I tried to make new friends, but I ran out of parts.
Right.
And given that you were talking about being almost like a dream stylist, I could totally see that. I think it often starts there. You start creating these environments that you want to be in. So since a lot of your work is about language revival and retention, and for the listeners, what I've seen is some of these videos where you have these kind of digital humans that are speaking your native language, and I guess maybe sometimes even teaching the language. This became important for you as an issue of identity, so you brought these tools that you already had on hand to bear. But this is your language. This is like a language you grew up speaking. I mean, in that sense, you are a native speaker. I'm asking because when I first looked at your projects, I was really curious because I know that having people that are continuing to speak some of these languages is getting to be a problem.
Yes, I'm a speaker. And even if I think I know what I'm doing, I have a group of people I check in with. Fluent speakers from Ganawaga, Six Nations, all over the place. Because I don't say I'm fluent. I always need someone that's not in my little bubble. Because there's some things that we're not supposed to share with the public. And sometimes I get so excited that, you know, they keep me in check. They're like, don't put that in the public. Not right now. And this is why.
When I was looking at your work and I was actually talking about this with a friend of mine, I felt that there were really some profound questions that come up as a result of this work. And one was, if you're using these digital creatures to sort of preserve the language, I was thinking, I hope they're getting it right, because it would be kind of ironic. Because that digital creature could live a lot longer than any of us. So my friend says, well, can I go look at this stuff? But I said, I don't know how much of this would really be available anyway. His point was, can a non-native speaker go and learn the language using these digital creature tools? And I said, I'm going to have to ask. I don't know. And he said, why? I said, well, it's not necessarily a tool for me to learn the language. Then he said, well, but if the language has fewer speakers or not very many speakers, is there something to be said for getting anybody speaking the language? And I said, I don't know. I'll ask her.
Welcome to my world. This is an everyday conversation. My big challenge is how to respond to them in a way that's respectful, because it can be triggering. But first off, anyone can learn to speak the language. It doesn't turn you into Ngwahumwe or Ganyangehaga person. So anyone can learn to speak the language, of course, but there's a lot of things and protocols going on where we hold each other accountable. Like for me, I have people that hold me accountable and they will publicly shame me if they need to. And that's what I'm talking about. You learn to not be led by fear. So you learn, you know, your place. I think one of the most important things, if you're non-Ngwahumwe or non-native learning these languages, you always, always, always remember you are not going to be a representative or a speaker for these people. As long as you remember that, you're going to be fine. And then you can communicate with the people. And even me, like I come from, and a lot of my friends too, we come from both, say, Ngwahumwe people and also genocider. Like it's in our DNA. And I think the worst thing that a person can do is not acknowledge that, because then they're not going to learn those things, like letting go of ego and remembering not to speak for your whole community, because you can't. Because I will never experience life with racism because of the color of my skin, because I look very pale. I don't experience that kind of racism. I never will. So as long as you remember that, I think everything's fine.
Do you call them AIs? What do you call your digital human speaking creations?
So I pushed back right up until last year. Like I was like, I will never make them look like human beings, because I just, that's so, like none of my AIs that come artificial intelligence, none of them have the goal of becoming human or any of that. Like there's no shame in being a software program. There's no shame in being an AI. There really isn't. It is what it is, you know. There's no shame in being a cartoon or a computer. You know, that's just how I was raised. The rock over there, the tree, it's not a shame to be a rock or a tree. That's how I look at it.
You are programming and teaching them to a certain degree to speak your native indigenous language.
Ganyangeha.
So anybody can go and sort of interact with these AIs to make their best attempt at learning the language. Your AIs are mostly straight language stuff. You're not dealing with what I would call the cultural stuff.
Yeah. And to be entertained. It's for entertainment. I mean, it's coming from my crazy imagination. And the language has already been preserved by a lot of people that lived way before me. So for me, it's like I'm building something with what they've already done. They preserved the language and the dialects. And as far as culture goes, like our ceremonies, things like that, I won't put it in there. This is me. I'm sharing how I see the world.
This seems like the right place. Before we close out this segment, I noticed that your AI language speakers, or at least the ones that I saw, had elf ears.
I had to really think about some of the influences. I love that movie Pan's Labyrinth with the faun. And whenever I build anything, it's to be reused and 360 films and all kinds of stuff. And so the one that you definitely saw is called Juanica Lago, which is Monica of the Forest. And I have this whole story that's being worked on now. It's like she's in the forest. You don't know what time era she's from. And I just love that idea of, like, maybe she's mixed like I am, and maybe she's mixed with a fawn. I don't know. I'm still working on it. Why does she have to have ears that we expect anyway? You know, maybe she has a tail too. We don't know if she has a tail yet.
To be honest, I expected to see an AI that looked like someone from the community. It was not that at all. And that actually made it much more interesting.
You know what, though, is she does look a little bit like some of the people here. They're like, were you looking at my picture? And I'm like, yeah. You know what? You probably are stuck in my mind a bit. The shape of your face. And yeah.
It's really cool stuff. Monigar, thank you so much for talking about this with us today. And if you would like more information about Monigar's work, you can visit mohawklanguage.ca or monigar.com, and that is monigarr.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum. I never dreamed that I would become a bus driver, but I